People were very, very kind to me. I got some good messages, and they actually, after all that, it ended up doing an episode. So
yeah,
it was kind of wild. I know, it was crazy. It was the day after that, and my mom wasn't feeling well. And so I decided to just watch the LIV golf hearing because Claire had put it in our Slack. She's like, this one might just be fun to watch. And I was like, all right. So I watched it in my editing software and was just kind of chopping it up really just for fun. And I ended up making like a basically giant montages of it. And I did an episode, the fastest episode I've ever done. And I actually feel like it turned out pretty well. So it was kind of nice because the announcement at the end of this show took a lot of the pressure off me. Without the pressure, I was able to actually enjoy the process. And yeah, so it was helpful, but I'm still so embarrassed.
You should not be embarrassed. So. It happens to the best of us. And I do think that, you know, there's no HR for us, right? There's no, like my wife gets paid by her company to have a like professional development coach. Right. That like helps her talk about what she should do and how she should navigate interpersonal relationships when it comes to business. And it's a good investment for a large company to help their employees communicate better and to manage themselves. So not only can they be better and healthier, but also the company can benefit from a healthy, happy employee. We don't get that. We just get raw praise. Direct money that we don't exactly know why it's coming in, and then vitriolic anger when people don't understand that we're humans and just think that we are voices in their heads. So like sometimes it does help to work some of this stuff out. And if we can make a little money on the side, all the better, in my opinion.
Can I add, there's also this like incredible, like, you know how there's Catholic guilt? I have farmer guilt. I have deep farmer guilt. Everyone in my family has a very, very adult job. Everyone in my family is either a farmer in construction or a federal judge. Literally everybody.
Yeah.
And then I went, or I'll be a clown, and decided to become a podcaster. Like the first 2 years I did this, it felt unreal to me the whole time. And then like yesterday, so this weekend I went out to Orkney, which is an island north of mainland Britain, way the hell out there. And I went out with my host family, Arthur and Gusha, had a lovely time. I went out largely because I wanted to bond with Arthur and Gusha, but also I'm working on this Bill Bryson style travel book about Scotland that I've been working on piecemeal for about 5 years now. And so yesterday I spent 8 hours working on that. And the whole time I felt guilty that I wasn't working on the podcast, even though I make money on books and I'm going to sell the book. But there was this thing in my back of my head that was like, this is just decadence. You're a fraud. You're sitting here just working like you're writing blog articles, you piece of shit. It's amazing how that and it like it's work. It's part of my job. But yeah.
Well, and it's creativity. Our friend, all of our friends Brian Brushwood is currently writing a book that he has been talking about nonstop for maybe as long as I've known him. And
was it about the cycle?
Yes. I've heard
stump speech multiple times.
When you scratch the surface of Brian, very barely, this idea pours out. And I've been trying to do my best as somebody that has been an editor of long form stuff and of short form stuff in the past to just let him know, like, there's two major phases for writing, especially long form stuff. There is the vomit phase, for which you are just getting everything out. And by the end of it, you are tired. You hate yourself. You are convinced that none of this is any good, that this is humiliating. You have debased yourself and wasted a lot of time. And then at the end of that, you can begin organizing it and editing it. And that's really where the project kind of comes, you know, something that is real, that then you can start to understand the worth of what you've actually done. But none of that is something that you teach. None of that is something that I learned in school. And I went to school for writing. Like it is just all a process by which you have to go through. And every moment, if you are not making your living doing that, and who is, unless you've already gone through this once, every moment you are thinking, especially in the lowest part of that initial valley, I'm wasting everybody's time. I've let myself down. I've let my family down. My ancestors are all looking down and shaking their head. This is the most self-indulgent, humiliating thing that I've ever done. And that is part of the process. Like that's the reason why not a lot of people finish it, because you usually stop yourself at that point and say, yeah, you're right, I do need to walk out. And the screwed up part about it is that's right at the end. That's always when you're at the lowest, and all you have to do is take like five steps forward and everything becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. You got to fight the self-indulgence. Cause the thing for me yesterday was just the fact that I was doing it on a Tuesday and I was like during work hours, like in my mind, all of my writing should be after 10 PM cause it's hobbyist and stuff like that. And I think the hard thing for a lot of people, by the way, is that people enjoy thinking about a book they want to write, and the actual sitting down and writing the book part, they're not that into, but the bit about thinking about it's fun.
Yeah. That's one of the more dangerous things you could ever say is, well, the book's already written in my head. No, it's not. No, it's not. that's, you know, I don't know.
I've had people approach me before. They're like, hey, you're a writer. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, I've got a great idea for a book. We could team up. You could do the writing.
Yes.
And I would, and I was like, stop right fucking there.
Yeah.
unless you're, yeah, no, we're not going to be doing that.
I've been trying to write more. I've been, because I do know that that's a thing that I just need to work the muscles on again. It's just so easy talking. I got seduced, like so many writers before me, I got so seduced by how much easier talking is and financially lucrative talking is than writing.
You know what bothers me?
That my fingers started to atrophy, and now they're just holograms.
I write a lot, but it's a kind of slap. It's not slapdash, but it's there's a real deadline, right? So when I'm doing a big monologue episode, which is where most of my writing is now, I nonetheless have to get it out a particular time. And so I have to kind of barrel through it. And I could tell that I'll go back and read prior writing and there'll be vocabulary words that I no longer know. And I'll be like, was it that I was a twat? And I just wanted to like impress everybody. And I got a thesaurus out. That's possible. But also I feel like I used to know that word. So is it that I only have so many words I can remember at a time? And like when I was in high school, before the internet was really like where it was right now, I did have a thesaurus and I would write down every word that I didn't understand. And I would come back later and I would read it in the thesaurus and I would write it down and was able to really radically expand. I don't do that anymore. I just look it on my Kindle and go, oh, that's what that means. And I move on. And so I feel like my vocabulary is no longer growing.
Is atrophying.
My favorite part of that story is when you asked, am I just being a twat? And Justin just starts nodding up and down.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Mexico City, Mexico,
I'm Jennifer Briney.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the podcast, we are going to talk about the recession. Will it show up? Is it already here? And are there class lines that define the entire conversation? That and a Freedom Caucus fracas between Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, all that plus your emails. Before we go any further, I don't know how many of these Groundhog Day segments we're going to have with news of a Trump indictment, but there was news that did come down on a Trump indictment. This one is for January 6th, something that Jen, you have said, has been the one that you have had your eye on from the very beginning. Do we have any thoughts on this beyond things that we have said or things that we would like to reiterate?
I mean, we were told that this was probably coming in August. We're in mid-July. So, and also like this news came from Trump that he was informed that he's a part of an investigation, has to talk to the grand jury. Like this, we're not actually there yet. But this is the indictment that I think the American people are going to be quite surprised what they read in this one based on my own experience of watching the January 6th committee, because the story is not the riot. The story is what happened in the months before that. And yesterday, I believe something like 16 people that were involved with forging the documents in, I think, Minnesota, which said that Trump won despite the fact Michigan. I knew there was an M.
Yes. There was state charges from the electors that were selected by the Trump team that tried to walk into the state capitol and were deterred from doing it. They were all charged for subverting the democratic process.
Yeah, there was quite a few counts for each of them. And so I think the American people are going to be surprised when they hear about what actually happened in the 2 months prior to January 6th. And I think this is the indictment, hopefully, that will do it. Because even the commentary that I've seen has been, oh, well, you know, like you can't say that Donald Trump was in charge of other people's actions on January 6th. Like that's still the storyline. So I'm just looking forward to the actual document. And I feel like this show is going to be best served when we can read it and then discuss what's actually in it. But right now, we really don't know anything. We knew this indictment was coming. This is just another sign that it's coming. I'm looking forward to reading the document and having the American people understand what the real story is, because it wasn't what happened on January 6th. It was the 2 months prior.
So I guess my question, if there were elements that were not part of that January 6th hearing, which took up a lot of time last summer, do you believe you want to have highlighted again? And why do you think that people would pay more attention to it now than they did during the January 6th hearing last summer?
Well, the January 6th hearings were 20 hours long. And so the American people did not watch those. And the ones that were in primetime were focused on the riot. So I think there was plenty of stuff within the January 6th hearings that are going to come as a surprise to the American people. Most notably, the fact that in 7 states, documents were forged and turned in saying that Trump won when he didn't. I mean, this was something that went far beyond just Donald Trump. There was a lot of people involved, just like, you know, you just pointed out, 16 people have now been indicted in Michigan. Mm-hmm. That's only one of the 7 states. And then there's all the phone calls that were made trying to pressure election officials to change the numbers. Like there was a lot of things that happened before the riot. And yet in a choice made by the Democrats, one that I think that is incredibly stupid, both in the impeachment and in the January 6th committee footage, They focused on the riot, and that is not the story. And I don't think that that's going to be central to the indictment in the way that it was in the coverage of the January 6th committee. So it's not necessarily that the committee didn't follow these storylines. It's that the American media didn't follow these storylines. It's still really unknown. Like, you know, I remember when I finished watching all of the January 6th hearings, my friend Brianna Joy Gray, who's now one of the co-hosts of Rising, a much larger show than ours, she had me on her podcast, Bad Faith, just to kind of summarize what I found for her. And she was surprised at the extent to what happened with the forged documents and all of that part of the storyline. So to be that into the news and to still miss it. And she said that my January 6th episode really helped her to like see the big picture by taking those 20 hours of hearings and condense it down into 2. That storyline just hasn't been told to the American people, and you can be so into the news and still miss it. So I think, I hope that with the next indictment, I think that is going to be central to it. I think it's going to be that storyline as opposed to the riot. I think it's going to be, you know, all the events that led up to it. I think it's going to be the Trump campaign pressuring the Justice Department. I think it's going to be the Trump campaign forging those documents. I think that is going to be so key to this. And all of the people that were tricked into participating in it, that's going to be the story here. And when it is in black and white in an indictment, I mean, we saw with the classified documents, everybody read the indictment. And so it's going to be very hard to pretend it didn't happen in the way that it's not hard now, because that storyline was never really covered. You know,
I think we have talked about it before. I'm sure we will talk about it again, that I would disagree with the idea that it wasn't really covered. Whether or not everybody has digested it the same way is a different story. If I were in the Trump campaign, I am thrilled. I am very, very excited. In fact, I want this indictment I want the Georgia indictment. And then if we could gin up two or three more by the time that Iowa comes around, because there is now a measurable effect of a 5 to 10 point bump every time that Donald Trump is indicted. And I think that from their perspective, they're going to think that the, especially the Republican electorate, is going to look at this as the third bite at the apple from an oppositional force. And that's the name of the game. I mean, I think this is going to be a political boon for Donald Trump.
I hope you're wrong. Like, I know why you say that, because with our politics and how disgusting we've allowed them to become, and the Republican Party's shamelessness and how they keep getting away with it and in fact getting rewarded for it, I understand why you say that. But I just hope that this is a bridge too far for people. I hope when they understand what happened, that they, that Donald Trump tried to stay president despite losing an election using fraud and forgery and tricking people. And like, is there ever going to be a line in our politics where it's too fucking far? And I really hope that this is going to be it, and that his poll numbers don't go up. Like, how disgusting are we going to be in the United States? How many times are we going to prove that we don't give a shit about democracy? And if his poll numbers go up, I don't know what we do with ourselves, because this is a bridge too far. This is too far, this one. And so I think we need to see the reaction first. We need to see the details, see what's actually in the indictment, and see how people react. But I'm really hoping that we are better than this, because once I realized how far this conspiracy, the fucking American people and even the Republican Party, because I know plenty of Republicans that are not anti-democracy and are not going to root on a guy who's basically promising to become a dictator. I mean, even I think it was like 2 days ago, he's saying that he wants to greatly expand, once he's president again, the powers of the president. Like, are we really just going to sleepwalk into letting this happen, especially with a guy like Donald Trump, who's awful? He's awful. And it's just what he did. And again, like, I really wish we weren't having this conversation right now, because I feel like I have more details than a lot of people do, because I produced the January 6th episode. I'm really looking forward to the American people having the same set of details about what happened between Election Day and January 6th. I can't wait for the American people to have those details, and then we can have this discussion about whether or not this is acceptable to us, because I find it so beyond unacceptable that I hope his poll numbers don't go up, because this is different from the classified documents and especially the Stormy Daniels bullshit. This is as serious as it gets. It's a president of the United States refusing, not just refusing to accept the results of an election, but trying to change them through back channels. It's completely unacceptable. And if his poll numbers go up, I will have a full-blown mental breakdown, because I just don't believe that we are this awful as Americans to accept that this is going to be okay.
Heaton?
My thoughts remain pretty much the same as they have for the last 4 months on this one. The only difference is that I am increasingly burned out on the topic of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I look forward to the day when he is a memory. I agree with everything Jen said, but I have nothing to add. I have missed any Trump-related news over the last 2 weeks to my great mental benefit.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the topics at hand. Goldman Sachs has reduced its prediction for a U.S. recession within the next year from 25% to 20% due to positive economic indicators. The bank's chief economist cited encouraging economic data, including the resilience of the U.S. economic activity, second quarter GDP growth tracking at 2.3%, decreasing unemployment rates, and the decline of initial jobless claims. Moreover, he suggested that curbing inflation to acceptable levels may not necessitate a recession. While Goldman Sachs foresees slower growth in future quarters due to deceleration in real disposable personal income growth, it remains optimistic about economic expansion due to easing financial conditions, a rebounding housing market, and a boom in factory building. The bank predicts a 25 basis point hike from the next Federal Reserve meeting, but anticipates that could be the last in this current cycle to curb inflation's rise. But meanwhile, according to Pew Research, by many measures, the U.S. economy is doing well and unemployment is at a 50-year low. Consumer spending is strong and the stock market is delivering solid returns for investors. But despite those positive indicators, public assessment of the economy is mixed and they differ significantly by income. The majorities of upper income and middle income Americans say that the current economic conditions are excellent or good. But about 4 in 10 lower income adults share that view, while the majority say that the economy is only fair to poor. And so I will ask our panel, Andrew Heaton, Do you feel good about the American economy right now?
I don't understand the question. I don't understand the idea of having feelings towards the economy. Like, I don't know what you mean. Like we can talk about, like,
you're generally working. This is not something that could have come up during the pre-show meeting. This is not something that could have come up during. You're just going to deny the point of the topic.
I'm hoping that some grist will be thrown in here. Let me see. I don't trust my feelings. I don't really trust attitudinal studies, and I don't fully understand, like, how do you feel about the economy? Doesn't make sense. Like how could we improve the economy makes sense to me.
Do you believe we will have a recession within the next year? If you are handicapping this in the same way that the banks are forced to handicap this, do you believe that?
I don't know. I hope that they're right. I'm not rooting for a recession, but I don't feel that I know enough about macroeconomic data to be able to predict that. I'm glad that the numbers are going down and that maybe inflation will be concluding.
Jen?
you kind of already said it in the rundown that your feelings on the economy really depend on who you are. I did read that article in the Pew Research Center, and one of the things I found fascinating about it is they kept saying, like, and it's, I mean, they did the numbers, who knows, but that lower income people feel worse than people with more income. And of course they do, because unemployment is low, but you have one person working three jobs because none of them pay enough to actually, like, afford housing and food and healthcare. So people that are in that situation are going to feel bad. But then what was notable to me was they count upper income as a family of three that gets $120,000 per year. That's top 10% here in the United States. And I can tell you, if you're a family of three living in New York or San Francisco, you are struggling. And their numbers actually showed that 14%, I think it was like 14% of people in that upper echelon say that they worry about paying their bills every day. And so here in the United States, if you can be in the top 10% and still be that financially insecure, we have a problem in this country. And so as far as, like, my feelings are concerned, like, I'm not thrilled about what's happening in the American economy. I know way too many people are struggling. And we all travel a lot throughout the United States, and we see people living in tents everywhere. So don't tell me that our economy is good while we can't even give people the basics. And some of those people living in tents, by the way, are not just drug addicts. These are people that are working, but again, they don't get paid enough to afford housing, because housing has become a gambling chip in the market here in the United States. I mean, we allow BlackRock to buy as many single family homes as they possibly can and rent them back to us for as much as they can get away with. Our healthcare is a total scam. Like, Americans are allowed to be charged for so many basic necessities at whatever the market decides. And we get price gouged in a way for our essentials that just doesn't happen in other countries. And so, no, I'm not thrilled with the American economy. I'm not surprised that Goldman Sachs is out there being like, yo, it's great. Because of course Goldman Sachs would say that, because the stock market's doing excellent. So, I mean, when you say, like, do I feel good about the economy, especially being in another country where basic essentials are not something that, you know, here in Mexico, people are price gouged for. No. I look at the American economy and I get really angry about the things that we pay top dollar for that other people don't. And I think it's really hard to be an American. I think those numbers proved it. Even the upper echelon is struggling. I don't see those numbers as positive and rosy. And yeah, that's how I feel.
Jen, I actually don't know a lot about Mexico. Would you rather be poor in Mexico or America?
Okay, I don't agree with that. I don't know. That's the thing. You know what? Actually, I would rather be poor in Mexico, to be honest with you, because here I am in Mexico City. I've been traveling all over the city and I've seen maybe two people that are living in squalor. I've seen maybe two people that are like zombies in the street. I'm getting all over Mexico City for under a dollar, like there and back. Like, public transportation is heavily subsidized. Housing is subsidized. Like, I don't know the Mexican economy that well, but I can tell you that I don't see in this major city what I see in San Francisco and LA and Austin and Dallas and so many places in the United States. Like, there is a social safety net that I've witnessed, and just basic essentials. I think people are able to access here.
I mean, that all sounds good to me, and I'm in favor of a social safety net. I just like, why are there so many people trying to come into the United States then? It would imply that they've got more opportunity over in the States than in Mexico.
You know, it's fascinating you say that, because Americans really do seem to think that everyone in Mexico is just trying to get into the States, and it's so not true. First of all, Mexico is
everybody,
being,
but there are some people.
Yeah, but a lot of them are also coming from Nicaragua and Honduras and El Salvador. Like, they're just coming through Mexico, okay. And we're making them stay. Haiti. In Mexico and Haiti, sure. But like, Mexicans are not, like, here in Mexico City, this is a very nice city. They are not trying to come to the United States. And it's quite insulting that Americans seem to think they're all trying to flee. That is just not the case. The quality of life here it's been fine. In fact,
I don't think all Mexicans are trying to get into America, but my guess is that it's probably regionally varied, that Mexico City is probably a more affluent part of Mexico. There's probably slums in Mexico City that are going to be off the beaten path. But this kind of gets back to the root question, though, of how we feel about the economy, Justin. Why the question confuses me is, I agree that there's lots of problems with the economy, but if we get into like, there are problems, we just end up defaulting on what we were already going to do to try to fix the economy. So I don't know that how we feel about it ends up making any informative choices on how we would do things differently. Like, well, I don't think that we should just maintain the status quo. There are lots of things I would do to change the economy, but it would kind of get back to like, do you trust the government or the market more? That's a flashpoint. Do you think that helping poor people would be better through like block grants and removing restrictions, or by trying to restrict rich people? Like, it kind of boils down to what we were going to do anyway.
Well, I do think that there is a very important vector in how America feels about the economy, in that we're about to get into a presidential election for which, you know, the president of the United States is running on Bidenomics. He is tying himself to this economy. And so if there is a recession, or if people don't feel good about what is not referred to as a recession, but they don't feel like they are better off now than they were 4 years ago, then that will have a political consequence. And it will probably benefit the person that is running against Joe Biden, because they're going to take political advantage of it, especially considering the strategic decision that is made. So while, yes, wishy-washy, and certainly not something that would make sense to a how do we actually fix this from a system level pathway of thinking, I think it does have a material consequence.
To back that up, you know, Biden's running around talking about Bidenomics as if like, you know, everything has gotten so much better. And yet, if you don't feel like it's gotten better, and he's telling you that Bidenomics is going to fix it or has fixed it, like everything is improving, and yet you're still working three jobs and you don't have healthcare that you feel like isn't going to bankrupt you if you get sick, like if you're feeling financially insecure and yet being told that the economy is great, you're going to be like, okay, whatever they're selling hasn't worked out for me. And so it does affect how people yes. vote. And I think that this whole line that Biden is going on, that Bidenomics has somehow fixed things, like, and to be told the economy is great, a lot of times that goes along with if the stock market is great. And I think there are so many people that are left out of that and that are going to vote accordingly. I think there was a lot of people that were left out of it when, at the end of the Obama years, when Hillary was saying that, you know, the Democrats were great on the economy. And then you have all these people whose jobs got shipped overseas. And they're like, well, it's not great for me. And so they voted for Trump. And I think that whoever taps into that feeling is going to do better in the election, because there's just too many of us that are seeing our neighbors living on the sidewalks. There are too many of us who are like, one illness and my family is bankrupted. There's too many of us who have for three decades been trying to pay off our college educations. Like, there's just too many of us that are feeling financially squeezed. And whoever speaks to that, I think, is going to do better in 2024, because it's exactly articles like this that are telling you everything is great and the recession's not coming. And yet if you feel like a loser, it doesn't match.
Justin, am I right in thinking, because I like attacking this from a political angle, am I right in thinking that whether the economy is good or bad has a lot less to do with whether you're a Republican or a Democrat and whether or not you're an incumbent or a challenger? That the incumbent's generally going to say the economy's going great, and the challenger's going to say, no, it's horrible. So like Trump, I mean, literally make America great again. He was running on the forgotten man, largely. Yes. That was why he did so well in the Rust Belt. He was going for a lot of the union people that used to be Democratic stalwarts. Mm-hmm. And now
But once he's in office, then the economy's chugging along and he's talking about all these things, right? So I'm guessing the incumbent president always is going to say the economy's, I've fixed the economy and it's doing great. You just need to let it run a while.
There's a lot of really, really good political kind of theater around this. Our friend Howard Mortman of The Weekly, the C-SPAN podcast, did a great episode about a year ago when there were two periods of very slightly negative economic growth, which technically is the definition of a recession. And the Biden administration was loath to use the R word. And so Howard Mortman went back into the past and showed how many times in the past with past administrations, how many words have been used to just not say the R word. Nobody ever wants to say the R word unless it's absolutely necessary and staring you in the face. So like slow down in the mud. Like there's a lot of metaphors.
It's kind of like there are two different metrics that are always used with unemployment. So whoever is the incumbent uses the unemployment rate. Whoever is not the the incumbent, whoever's the outside party will say the unemployment rate's not the important thing.
Exactly.
The actual work rate is the thing, which is true. It is the work rate. I don't remember the exact term, but it's the amount of people actively working is the relevant thing.
Rate, as it is because oft referred to.
People that have completely dropped out and are not filing for unemployment are not counted in that. And people that have either given up or gone, I'm just going to take disability and that's it. They're all in that. So that's a more accurate representation of how well-employed people are. But both parties immediately flip. The second, like all those people that were like, you're trying to do a sleight of hand by saying the unemployment rate. The second they come into power, they're like, yeah, they're using that same data because it's always better. It always looks better.
It's almost as if political parties are there to persuade and not necessarily to educate. But we digress. We move on. Reason why Joe Biden, in my opinion, is running on the Bidenomics thing is right here in this Pew survey. Upper and middle class people who are largely now the makeup of the Democratic Party that get out to vote in cities are not feeling bad about the economy. They didn't really feel all that bad with COVID when it came. You know, most of the Democratic voters had a disproportionate number of people that got to work from home and now continued to get to work from home even after lockdown restrictions are over. So this has not necessarily been that big of an onerous issue. And the lower class that were disproportionately affected by lockdown policies and now have long since for the last, you know, several decades felt disenfranchised and don't feel like this economy is particularly working for them, they are not necessarily Democratic voters, or at least Democratic voters that Democrats are worried will leave the coalition. Democrats believe that elements of inner city working poor and progressives hate the Republicans so much they will never stray at all, that they are locked in and baked into that coalition.
That's exactly the calculus. And the reality of it is that middle and lower class Americans are not being represented by either of the parties right now, because the Republicans have been the party of the rich for a long time. Donald Trump, I think, essentially tricked people into thinking that he was going to give a shit about the working class. And then he did tax cuts for the rich, still running on that type of stuff. I mean, the Republicans, they represent the rich. They just do. And so the Democrats think that they have everybody else captured. And that is a really cynical way to be. And I don't think they're captured. And I think Cornel West is a very interesting third party candidate this time. And I think the Democrats should be nervous about it, because that's someone that I actually believe cares about the working class in a way that I don't think Joe Biden does. I think your calculus on this, Justin, is absolutely correct, that Bidenomics is really appealing to the college educated donor class that the Democrats now represent. And there are a lot of us that feel unrepresented by these two parties, and we're looking for something else. And Cornel West is a real option. So, that's going to be fascinating to see how many people break off. Because right now, if the choices, I mean, obviously, from my rant at the beginning of this episode, I think the Republican Party has lost all morals that it has if Donald Trump is at the top of their ticket. The Republican Party becomes unacceptable to me in general if he's on the top of their ticket again. And so obviously I won't be voting for him, and I'm going to really struggle to vote for Joe Biden.
Considering how glowing you've always referred to them, that's a real steep drop.
You know, here's the thing though, that people don't understand, because I don't think the audience knows me all that well. I have been registered for one political party, and it was the Republicans. I was raised by Republicans. I was a Republican. So that's one of the reasons I get so upset about what they have actually done with their power and what they've become. It's because I was raised, you know, by Reagan Republicans. I was raised by fiscal conservatives. I was raised by people that, you know, my family, they worked very hard. They were not upper class and they worked. And so like, there's some bitterness having a lot of their paychecks taken out. Like that was the kind of Republican they were. And back when like the 1980s, I've gone back in the C-SPAN archives, Republicans were not insane. And this breed of Republican Party, we're about to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, which like, ew, I don't know why we're about to do that, but like we are, we now have that kind of Republican in Congress. We have Donald Trump at the top of their ticket. So when I say that the Republicans have become something different, this isn't just me saying that. Michael Steele is saying that. He used to be the head of the RNC. Like this is a different thing, this Republican Party. And I think it's about time we start talking about how unacceptable it's become. And if a man who tried to remain president through fraud and political pressure on secretaries of state is at the top of their ticket, that is a level of unacceptable. And so what I'm saying is that there's so many people in this country now that feel unrepresented by this crazy Republican Party and this bought off Democratic Party. There's a lot of us that just don't feel represented. I'm curious to see how well Cornel West does, because like someone has to represent these lower and middle class people. These two parties aren't doing it, at least as of the front runners right now. It'll be interesting to see how many people say that they're done with the Democrats and Republicans. And when you look at these feelings about the economy and you have Biden saying that everything's great, there's going to be a lot of people that just don't feel that way. And we'll be looking for an alternative.
Eaton, did you see your boy taking a step back into the national spotlight? No Which, labels.
Who's my boy in this instance? Mitch Daniels?
John Huntsman.
John Huntsman? Yeah. Oh, that's right, because John Huntsman is palling around with
Joe Manchin.
The Democrats hate no labels. And I'm like, but John Huntsman's a Republican. And then there was another guy that was, it was like Jeff Flake or somebody. One of the Republicans I like.
Larry Hogan of Maryland was also.
Larry Hogan, one of the Republicans I like was toying around with that.
Yeah, the rollout in New Hampshire. I think it might break up this podcast if you become a vocal supporter of a Joe Manchin, John Huntsman ticket.
I would love
John Huntsman's
at the top of it. I would prefer no. John Huntsman at the top of that ticket over Joe Manchin very much. But I mean, this is one of the things that happens every election, right? Is that the Democrats and Republicans both go, hey, everything Jen just said, there's a lot to that. You know, that there, you know, we could do better in representing certain groups, but at the end of the day, this election, for real though, this election, you can't vote third party. You would, let's just get this done. And then we will deal with your concerns. And they've been doing it for 30 years. They've been doing it. There's never going to be a moment where the Democrats and Republicans do not portray this as an existential battle. And if you dare step out of that dichotomy between the party of garbage and the party of hot garbage, that you will ruin America. I do want to throw out a couple of things. I want to come back to Cornel West because I did not know he was running. And I want to know more about this in a moment. But I'll bring up another thinker that's pertinent to that part of the conversation, who is Musa Algarve, who's appeared on both Justin and my program. Great guy. I really like Musa. Musa Algarve does really, he's a sociology professor up at Columbia, and he does really interesting data analysis of polling. And he's very contrarian by nature. And I gather that he really dislikes high-handed upper middle class people that just assume they know everything. He kind of bucks that thing. So he went through the last election data and the prior election data, and he brings up that look like as much as kind of everybody, including myself, thinks that Mitt Romney is a better person than Donald Trump and less racist than Donald Trump and so on and so forth. Donald Trump did better with Hispanics and black voters than Romney did. And then he beat himself in 2020, right? If I were the Democrats, I would be very worried about that, because I think the Democrats have, and both of you have pointed this out, they both have sort of believe they've got a permanent lock on racial demography, which I do not think is the case. You go back to like 1963, most black people were Republican, if I'm not mistaken. If not, it was around 50-50. Like it's not as if these things are permanent.
The thing that, I'm struck by as we discuss Trump and we discuss Cornel West and some other people is just I've kind of been noodling this recently, the disconnect between rhetoric and governance.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time they're different. So like Biden is governing as I would say like a neoliberal plus massive, massive subsidies. That's kind of my interpretation of Bidenomics is he's kind of coming out of this centrist, basically neoliberal framework, but with massive spending, right? But he speaks rhetorically as a union guy. His rhetoric has always been
yes.
rolled up his sleeves. I just got off the train from Delaware. My mom and my dad were in a union. They were swingers with people in a union. Everyone in our, he's very much a union guy. Donald Trump ran as this like fiery populist, stick it in the eye of the establishment. His governance, when you remove all the batshit crazy stuff, all the rhetoric, all the tweets, you remove all the language, it wasn't that different than a regular Republican. I'm over here in the United Kingdom right now, and when I talk to my Scottish friends, I'm told I sound like a super uber Tory to them. But I'm for nationalizing the Duchy of Cornwall and stuff. That's a basically a way of saying like I would expropriate most of the royal family's wealth and put it in a big national sovereign wealth fund, which is a very like commie like thing to do. But I just don't sound that way, so I'm always interpreted as like a super Tory, and I think it's interesting that disconnect that continues to happen. I'll say on that end, I think my biggest fault with Trump, who I've been a vocal critic of the whole time, is I have a very difficult time being able to analyze his governance without being clouded by the rhetoric. The rhetoric has a big effect on me. And thus, like, I kind of get inflamed so quickly that it's difficult for me to peer through the fog of tweets to what's actually happening. And I'm aware that that's going on with me. So all that being said, I want to hear, who is Cornel West running as an independent? Is he running with a particular party? What's happening?
He announced his running with the Working Families Party, and then the Green Party was like, wait, what? And then he said, I tried to ask you if I could run on your party. And they said, well, do you want to run in our party? And he said, sure. And so now he's the Green candidate. So he will have ballot access in the vast majority of states.
That's a thing.
And I look forward to hearing why he's a white supremacist. That is going to be one of my favorite, my favorite parts of the 2024 election is to read a very serious Atlantic article about how Cornel West has propagated white supremacy.
I did not know that he got the Green nomination. So I've hung out with Jill Stein before, and I interviewed Howie Hawkins last time. I really like Howie Hawkins. I really enjoyed that guy. If I were in the Senate, I think we'd be buddies if he was in the Senate. Obviously, I disagree with him on a bunch of stuff, but there was a surprising amount of overlap there, and I just personally liked him a lot. Cornel West has a lot more name recognition and a lot more media clout than Jill Stein or Howie Hawkins have ever had combined. So that the spoiler capacity for him is much higher than with previous Green Party candidates. Plus, depending on how he wants to run it, prior to Jill Stein, like basically when Ralph Nader played perhaps the role of a spoiler party candidate back in 2000, the Green Party went, oh, fuck, and had a very conscious decision not to apply any effort in swing states. And then that changed around Jill Stein. If Cornel West actually wanted to just do stump speeches in swing states, he could do a lot of damage.
My position is resolute. It's not the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or the No Labels Party's job to get a Democrat or a Republican elected. It's their job to speak for the people that believe in them. I think if you are weak-willed and start to look at this from DC brain rot positions of game theory, regardless how correct they are, then you're not speaking for the people that believe in you. And so either you actually want to do this or you want to just better your standing in DC. And I think that oftentimes weak-willed people like Bill Weld, who has low moral character, blink in the face of that pressure. But otherwise, I have a lot of respect for everybody who runs, especially with the face of the kind of hate that third parties get. It gets really, really intense the closer that you get to nut cutting time.
The pro candidacy back in 92 is one of the most studied elections in the entire country. We've got very good data on this. he didn't spoil the goddamned election. What happened was he drew equally from Republicans and Democrats, but the majority of his supporters were people that went, fuck it, I'm not going to vote. And then he ran and they went, actually, I like that guy. I'm going to vote for him. And so like there's what 49% of the American public doesn't vote in presidential elections. And that's generally who the third party's going for, is the people that were going to stay home. So that's who they're competing over.
And like also, let's say they did. What else do the two parties want? More money? More clout? More voter registration? Like, what other advantages do you want if you are not able to overtake this ragtag group of nothing, right? Everybody's freaking out about No Labels. Oh my God, No Labels. We don't know who the No Labels donors are. We don't know what they want. Let's say they were Cobra from G.I. Joe. Let's say they were actually evil. They do not have the same amount of money that Joe Biden is going to raise. They do not have the same brand loyalty that the Democratic Party has. They do not have the same party infrastructure. And so if you're really looking at this in an X's and O's position and you can't handle $100 million coming from somebody that you don't know, regardless of their position of what they want the world to be or not to be, then it's on you, my friends. It is on you, the two main parties, because we have created a system for which you have tremendous advantage in almost every conceivable metric. And right now they are trying to smother that in the crib. I don't blame them for doing it, because that is the way that they are going to try and tar and feather this movement before it can cement its own position to the American public. But I will point back, I will point out, I don't know what else you want. Except for other people to say, in deference to you, great Republican or Democratic Party, I will not do anything because your careers are better than my career.
What they want is for the American electorate to remain in a place of fear and hatred, because that is an easy situation to manipulate and bilk for money. And the last thing they want is for people to actually have multiple choices so that they can vote based on their ideology, their values, or policy prescriptions, rather than voting to stop somebody else. That's what they want. They want a system based on stopping the bad guy.
And for the record, I usually defend the duopoly. I just think, don't whine. It's just unseemly. Go ahead, Jay.
Well, especially with that particular line of attack, as if there's no dark money coming to Republicans and Democrats.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. We know it. Where every bit of super PAC money comes in for everybody. Well, speaking of our economy, we're feeling good here. All politics are local, and our economy is doing very, very well. Thanks to you, the dear listener, at patreon.com/we're not wrong. We summited Mount 900, and now there is but one gigantic peak that stands before us: 1,000 patrons. That's it. We have less than 100 to go before we get over that 1,000 patron mountain. And I know that that's around where all of our separate patrons, Patreons are. So this is a big deal. This means that together we were able to create a community that is on the par with the stuff that we have created careers on. And we look very, very, very forward to making it worth your while. If you have been on the fence on this, patreon.com/we're not wrong, you get a bonus topic each and every week. Two topics normally on the show. Bonus third topic for you if you're a patron. And this week it's going to be about who else? George Santos possibly being censured by dun 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 Republicans. The Republican Party turned against George Santos. And to be honest, these topics, they tend to get a little wild. We don't always stay on the lead topic. There's often things that we don't like saying in the main feed that we say in the Patreon.
There was like a whole month where we got into porn.
AI
porn.
And
then the following month we got into conspiracy theories. It was like we had these like weird subconscious themes that we would all gravitate towards.
Exactly. So there we go. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Let's talk about a topic that might make Jen quit the podcast. Amidst an escalating feud between Republicans Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, Republican Tennessee Representative Tim Burchett warned of the possibility of a physical altercation between the two, comparing their rivalry to professional wrestling.
He remarked on the entertainment value of the situation, while another anonymous Republican lawmaker emphasized the detrimental impact of prolonged internal rifts. This tension intensified when Green, who later voiced confusion over the exact reasons, was expelled from the Freedom Caucus after derogatorily referring to Boebert as, and we quote, a little bitch. Green subsequently brushed off the incident, dismissing it as mere drama club antics. We weren't going to talk about this topic. We were going to talk about an American soldier being taken captive by the North Koreans and whether or not his dipshit antics might provoke World War III. But late at night, and I have no idea whether or not it was any kind of a number of pints in, one Andrew Heaton came into our group chat and said, can somebody please explain? He's flashing three pints in. Heaton says, can somebody please explain to me why Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert are fighting? And so I ask you, Heaton, what do you want to know?
Okay, here's what I want to know. Typically, when you try to explain the behavior of people you don't like as they're crazy shitbags,
yeah,
typically you're missing something there, right? So like if Jen, you were talking earlier in our program about how a lot of the gains that Donald Trump made were by people that are working lower economic quintiles that felt left behind. And that explains a lot of his electoral appeal, right? But like initially, right after the election, the Democratic tagline right out the gate was like, people are sexist. That's it. America's. And it was like, well, no, you guys are missing to your detriment. You are missing this thing. And I also know that anytime that you're just basic group dynamics, whatever group you're a part of, this is how human beings work. Whatever our group is it's incredibly diverse and varied. The personalities are so distinct. It's amazing we can even get together. We're such a motley crew. And the other groups, oh my God, they're all lockstep. The bad team's lock. Everybody thinks this. The other team is monolithic and lockstep. That's how we always work. So from where I'm at, looking at Boebert and Green, and they hate each other, I'm like, it can't just be that they're crazy. There has to be something deeper. There has to be some paradigm that I don't know or some fault line within the Republican Party that I'm unaware of. And so I want you to help elucidate that for me, because I want to take some of my own medicine and try to figure out what I'm missing here.
Jen, go ahead.
No, I don't know these people. You know, this is what I think is going on here. I think I cried at the end of the last episode, and people showed a lot of support, and we got some more patrons. And the reason I cried is because this Congress was so fucking dumb that it was breaking my soul. And so we decide to have this topic on this episode while I'm on a bus with my mother. I was not in this little meeting. I woke up this morning to see, Jen, you've been warned in all caps that this was happening. Like, you guys, there are people in this Congress that are just awful, and we don't have to analyze them, and we don't have to give them any more attention than they deserve. These are two people that have proven themselves to be immature, and they're showing it on the House floor. This is exactly what I was talking about in the Republican Party of the, they have been rewarded in that party for behaving badly. Joe Wilson was one of the first people to scream in the middle of a State of the Union address. And in the last one, these very two women, Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, are sitting two seats away from each other, screaming like banshees at the president of the United States. We have a I don't know what word I'm looking for, but there used to be a level of statesman that was required to be
decorum.
Thank you. I knew it started with a D. There was a level of decorum.
Yeah.
It has been eroded over my lifetime. And these two are just symptoms of it. And so every time they behave badly, the media gives them the attention that they seek. These are attention whores getting the attention that they seek. And so, you know, that's a fight that could have happened in the hallway or in their offices. But why did they do it on the House floor? Because of this. Because we are paying attention and we are talking about them. They have become celebrities. Meanwhile, you have people like Patty Murray, the senator from Washington, who's sitting in her office writing bills and getting her job done. And who pays attention to her? No one. So that's what this is. It's attention whores becoming famous. I really think it's that simple.
So this is sort of the reality television-ism.
Well,
reality television-ication.
Everything that Jen has said in terms of them screaming during the State of the Union is absolutely true. I long for the days of decorum where the Speaker of the House only ripped up the speech of the president behind his back in front of all the cameras. That was such a more regal age.
She's awful too. I'm not defending
that
her.
That being said, this, I know I'm joshing.
All right.
This is actually a situation where either of them particularly want this story to be out there. The little bitch quote came from an article that was reported from people who said they saw it on the House floor. It was not anything that was loud or in front of a camera or on a Fox News hit, of which they are both prodigious users of. Here's the big reality of this. Marjorie Taylor Greene understands that tying herself to Donald Trump is very, very, very profitable for her and could quite possibly, just going to say it to everybody so you begin to socialize it in your head, a likely vice presidential selection. And that would make her, with a lame duck Donald Trump, if he were to win in 2024, the favorite to be the president of the United States in 2028, Marjorie Taylor Greene. So she understands that tying herself to Donald Trump is something that is very, very, very advantageous to her. It's the reason why, and this is where she started to have a split with the House Freedom Caucus. Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert were two people for whom were very much anti Kevin McCarthy being the Speaker of the House. They wanted the scalp of Kevin McCarthy killing his nomination on their wall. Marjorie Taylor Greene was on the other side of that. And she, because she was part of the Freedom Caucus, was an important whip element of trying to get everybody in line. This is where we saw the first reported element of anger between Boebert and Greene. It was a bathroom incident where
I remember that
where yeah. Greene was yelling at Boebert saying, how much money did I raise for you? How many times did I help your reelection? And you only were able to be reelected by 600 votes, which is true. So she felt that Boebert and many other members of the House Freedom Caucus that were happy to have Greene come out and do campaign events and raise money for her now were turning their back on her when she was like, hey, look, it's better for everybody that Kevin McCarthy gets the speakership, which eventually wound up happening anyway. Matt Rosendale is allegedly, according to some reporting, can still pissed off because as that cataclysmic final hours in McCarthy's speakership ascension were happening, Rosendale was still a no, and Marjorie Taylor Greene was pictured holding a phone out to Rosendale while he waved it off with the caller ID showing DJT, so Donald Trump. Like, this was her trying to hand Rosendale the call because Trump was trying to tell Rosendale to vote for McCarthy. There's a lot of bad blood. This has escalated beyond that for these reasons, because the House Freedom Caucus doesn't have much love for her anymore. She has aligned herself more with the power structure of McCarthy because Trump has backed McCarthy. Nobody will speak out against Trump because Trump is the center, the sun of the MAGA universe. So the frustration then goes to somebody that is more touchable, which is Greene. And I will sum all this up by saying, and Heaton, I'd be curious your perspective as somebody who spent time on the House. This is wholly unremarkable. People hate each other as representatives and senators for reasons that are like this and have forever. And spoiler alert, they've called each other names that are far more vile than little bitch. They have called each other names and they are on tape. Listen to those LBJ tapes and hear how he talks about various different members of the House and Senate, both when he was a senator and when he was a president. Indeed, I will say that this is tinged with misogyny, that it is because they are women and it is because the idea of two women fighting with each other is an idea of a cat fight. By House standards, they are attractive people. Congress, not exactly known for, you know, their
for being 98 years old is the average age. It's a pretty good looking house full of people.
I mean, and so I think that that's why this is here, that that we love the idea of a cat fight. And when you put them as your key art, people will click. But I do think that it is notable that while Jen is right, there's been a lot of reprehensible behavior that have come out of them in terms of eroding decorum on the House floor. And I would agree with you, Jen, that it has been a steady decline. And this is just the last, you know, layer to be chipped away. This particular situation is Hill reporters finding a fissure and covering it as a behind the scenes back and forth.
Okay. So if I'm putting this all together, because I have not, I really don't know that much about either of these ladies. Jen, your principal identification here is that this is behavior that keeps getting rewarded with additional media attention and therefore begots a cycle of media attention antics. And Justin, you're saying that the fissure point itself is basically just personality driven. Cause I looked at it and I was like, again, like I'm looking at this going, okay, maybe one of them's like a populist, but one of the other ones like a social conservative.
No.
And somehow it's nothing. There's no high-minded stuff or worldviews operating this. This is just, they don't like each other and they're vying
I mean, I'm sure you knew when you were in the House, some representatives just don't like each other, that somebody promised them that they were going to vote for a thing or where they were going to go campaign for them. And then they didn't. And so now it's, well, fuck that guy. You know, this happens all the time in the business of representative politics.
I will say on a rare optimistic note about our elected representatives, while I was there, I actually didn't hear that much shit talk. Now, that's granted, I wasn't very high on the office hierarchy, so it's entirely possible that the congressman that I knew, you know, didn't feel compelled to really dish about the other ones. But what I did become aware of was all the kind of quiet bipartisan friendships that were there. Those are very common. Mm-hmm. I'm told it's less common now. My colleagues that are still on the Hill tell me that kind of around the Tea Party, that really started declining and that you don't see that as much as you did. But when I was there anyway, and not that long ago, James Inhofe, who's a senior, very conservative senator from Oklahoma, was very good friends with Dianne Feinstein.
Barbara Boxer.
They would like, Barbara Boxer, yeah, they hung out. He tried to get her to campaign for his opponent because he thought that they'd hang out in Oklahoma, and also he knew it would only help him. But it was kind of an optimistic thing I got out of the experience was that a surprising amount of people like each other, but it would also follow. I think there's a sort of self-selection that happens with people that are running for higher office, which tends to be a lot of confidence, a lot of ambition, and a lot of ego. And one would think that that personality type would be prone to friction with other large personality types.
Yeah. And that's simply what's happening here. And, you know, to be totally honest, I think that this is going to be something that probably, I would not be shocked if Lauren Boebert loses her seat. She almost lost her seat in the last cycle. I think she's going to have less money going to her this time. And the Democrats smell blood, and she is a big ticket face and name to take down in the 2024 cycle. Colorado is a blue state, and so you will have heavy turnout for Joe Biden, presuming he is the nominee. I think that there is a good chance that she loses her seat, and it will be in part because there is this fissure within the House Freedom Caucus, which anybody who's trying to herd those cats, good luck.
Well, I guess like that's, as I'm sitting here, just like thinking about the juxtaposition between our two topics today, where we talk about the economy and the unaffordability of housing and healthcare and all these things. And these are the people that are being expected to solve those problems. And the politics of it, like we know that these two people had a fight in a bathroom and they had a fight on the House floor. And we wonder why our country is not feeling like it's improving in any real way. Like, we need to have our politics at some point match our governing, because this is exactly the type of stupid that I'm talking about with the frustration that I've been feeling and like feeling like Congress could do so much good. And yet these are the people that we're populating with it. And this is the type of behavior that's getting highlighted instead of the things that actually matter in that Congress. Like we have Hill reporters, as you said, Justin, that are pushing out this story, that are following them into bathrooms and are making sure that we have this on the front of our brains instead of what bills are being written, if there's any being written at all. because as we're going to talk about in the Patreon, they're going to censure yet another member of Congress. And censures are kind of not a thing. Like, they have no repercussions whatsoever. So it's like they are doing politics all the time. Where's the governing? Where are the serious people? They're not getting the attention. And this Congress is the worst I've ever seen. This is a perfect example of it. It's frustrating. This is why I was crying last week. It's because of exactly this. These are not people that should be in power. They should not be getting this level of attention.
Well, Heaton, for selecting this topic, I would like to call you a little bitch.
Thank you. Jen, I did not pick this to add.
I know you didn't. I'm teasing you. And it's like, I saw it this morning. I was like, are you fucking serious right now? Because I saw Justin had a totally different topic. I'm like, yeah, we can talk about that. And then you switched it with these two clowns. I was like, he just wants more money. He wants me to cry again.
Every day that I get more money and Jen cries is a good one. However, that one is not what occurred to me yesterday.
No. Heaton selected the topic for the most Heaton reason possible. He's like, well, there must be some kind of deep ideological divide that I'm not grokking. Like,
I'm looking at my org chart, and to me, they look like they're in the same quadrant. I don't even understand what they're fighting about.
Yeah, you actually...
Who's their favorite Lockean thinker?
Exactly.
Which social contract theorist do they adhere to?
I mean, you were very cute in this chat. You're like, no, surely it can't be that stupid. And Justin's like, oh, it can. So, yeah. Heaton, I know you're not trying to make me cry. I know I'm teasing you, but Jesus Christ, these two are, we need to stop paying attention to them.
By the way, for the record, I encourage everybody to go listen to the LBJ tapes. That it's on audiobook. I believe they're posted for free. But if you want to hear somebody who is world renowned for being among the best manipulators in congressional history, and you want to hear how they talk to each other and how they talk about each other, trust me, somebody getting called a little bitch is not the worst thing on the planet.
I've been to the LBJ Museum twice, once with Justin Robert Young, and then when my dad came down to visit, we went to go check it out. I have to suspend my high-minded, what should the politicians be doing bit, and just think of them in terms of, like, how good are they as politicians vocationally? And that man was probably the finest politician we've ever had, just in terms of getting things done. And the tapes are amazing. Like, you listen to him and, like, he'll listen, I'm gonna get the thing passed. You gotta get me those fucking tax bill. Like, he's just wheeling and dealing. And my favorite tape is that it's right after Kennedy got shot and the church commission's being organized, and he wants to bring on some senator to sit on it. And the senator's like, Mr. President, I appreciate what you're doing, but I can't serve with Earl Warren. I have a deep antipathy for that man. I can't serve with him. And he's just like, I know, but you were in the army. You served with whoever you needed to. You're a fine American. You'll serve with Earl Warren. And he's like, I just don't feel comfortable. And he's like, yes, and yet you will rise to the occasion. You will rise to the... And he just refuses to even acknowledge. It just keeps like, yep, no, you're a fine American. You're going to sit on the committee. I'm telling you right now, you'll be on that committee. I look forward to hearing your results. I just don't feel comfortable. Well, it's not about what, you know, whether you're comfortable or not. Like, it's worth checking out.
Then
I'll throw it to Justin and I, as a Patreon episode on the Political Orphanage, we did a whole episode on Drunk Nixon tapes one time, which was really fun, where I tracked out a bunch of tapes of Drunk Nixon, and we listened to them and then did a play-by-play.
Drunk Nixon is its own world. LBJ had a few go-to moves. Whenever he was dealing with people not from the South, he would really dial up the I'm just dumber than a brick and uglier than a mule's daughter from Hill Country, Texas. And like, oh, geez, he would always love to talk about how much the other guy, when he wanted to build him up, was so sexy and virile that he might just fuck his wife. He might fuck Lady Bird. Like, so he's like, well, now my wife, you know, if you go out with her, just make sure to treat her nice, you know. And he would always do it to the very patrician people because he knows that that would destabilize him. As soon as he started talking about nuts or his dick or like fucking his wife, he knew that they would get kind of grossed out and weird. All these prep school New England kids, one of the best congressional manipulators, but sparing anything was not on his list. Go ahead, Jen.
How many of these tapes were about LBJ sorting out who's the queen bee of the Freedom Caucus? Is this a tale as old as time?
I mean, he certainly understood where all the power was. And if you look at the comparisons of like, all right. So for those of you who don't know, LBJ compulsively taped everything. He started taping stuff when he was in the Senate. And the reason why he did it was because he never wanted to leave up to his memory what people had promised him. And he wanted to know who was being honest and who was trying to fuck him. So he secretly recorded everybody, both on phone taps and with microphones in his office, and then would have his secretary transcribe them. So the next time that they were in a negotiation, he'd be able to say, well, now you did promise me X, Y, and Z. And if they said, well, that's not how I remember it, he'd be like, I'm pretty sure that you promised me X, Y, and Z. And he would never divulge it. When he became president, he brought that to the White House. The taping system that Nixon got busted for was LBJ's. LBJ put all that stuff in the White House. And so that's what Nixon wound up getting busted for. Now, Nixon kept it. Nixon could have said, get this out of here. I don't feel comfortable with it. Nixon did keep it, and he was a paranoid enough man that he certainly used it. But that was all of LBJ's, and he did it specifically for those reasons, Jen, because he wanted to know everybody's exact opinion on everybody. He wanted to know exactly what they wanted, exactly what they feared, so he could keep it organized and be a more effective general in the Senate.
Jesus Christ. Maybe that's a law that we should push for. Which is that everything should be recorded in the people's houses, House, Senate, their offices, White House.
Live stream it.
Live stream it all. And then I think it couldn't be as dirty anymore, could it? Because we would all be able to sit in on their conversations.
Or they'll just do all of their work in saunas or something. I don't know. I think it would probably help. I don't think it would, like, if I'm corrupt, I'm just going to go meet somebody at a playground or something to talk about the corrupt shit at that point. But it would be fun for everybody. Al Gore, when he ran, proposed having the Oval Office on live stream. That was something that he was going to do if he'd been elected office.
Well, and like, I'm making kind of a whole career out of the fact that no one watches C-SPAN. We have the cameras in there. We have them in the committees. No one watches them anyway. But like, if we just had them in all these offices, maybe no one would watch them. Or maybe they'd be pain in the asses like you and me. And like, we could shine the light on this shit. I just think that more transparency would be good because right now we don't have any LBJ tapes, and I would like to hear the Trump tapes and the George W. tapes and even the Obama tapes. I'd like to hear all the tapes. I think that'd be great.
Me too. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Pierce the veil of your own reality only to see yourself beginning your contemplation. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. A qualified defense of horoscopes writes, at a time when everyone worked in sustenance agriculture, your date of birth probably did affect what age you encountered different seasons. E.g., teaching talking age when everybody else is indoors for winter probably affected your sociability. Was it determinative? Of course not. Does it matter less since the Industrial Revolution? Of course. But between kids in the same country in 1700, I bet you could find statistically significant patterns based on horoscope signs.
That is interesting. There's some logic to it. I doubt it. I doubt that if we go back to, again, well the fuck beyond anybody currently alive was born, but okay, let's go back to then. It seems, while there's logic to that, which is more than I can say about horoscopes today, and I applaud you on that for actually engaging some sort of rationale or origin point for this. It seems unlikely to me that everybody born in January in the year 1500 would have similar personality attributes because their mom had access to strawberries or something like that, right? I think that that's it. It's interesting. Maybe. Certainly doesn't apply today.
Logan Paul is a public health utility, writes, this weekend I was doing my shopping at Walmart and I was in the drink aisle looking for tonic water. I overheard a father and son arguing about what he wanted to pack in his cooler for Little League the next day. To quote the dad, you're going to trade 2 6-packs of Mountain Dew for some Logan Paul bullshit. The kid mumbled something about his friends drinking it too. And this emailer actually went on to say that he works in public health and that the state that he's in has such a problem with dental health because of Mountain Dew, he genuinely believes this could affect the populace of his state if they drank less physical Mountain Dew because they were into Logan Paul, if this father's rules of a 3-to-1 trade continued to hold.
Wow.
Fascinating.
Star Trek Metaphor writes, Heaton is the systemic logical Spock in a waistcoat. Jen is the taller McCoy with much better hair, providing the human, empathetic, and occasionally outraged perspective. And Jury, he's a bearded Kirk in the captain's chair, steering the ship and looking toward the next political campaign season like it was a Las Vegas convention of Intergalactic Society of Green Chicks.
I think that's exactly right. And well done on your Star Trek analogy.
I have no idea what you just said.
Vote or Die writes... Vote or Die, right? So any country with a wartime election isn't a democracy? Cool, cool. I can listen to arguments that Ukraine shouldn't join NATO for global security reasons, but I can't listen to arguments that Ukraine doesn't deserve it.
A country that bans political opposition parties and cancels all its elections? Yeah, I struggle to call that a democracy.
And for the record, you know, this conversation has evolved in the last week. Both Ukraine and America have said, indeed, there are conditions that have yet to be met. And I would imagine that scheduling elections and allowing by law opposition parties would be among the, conditions that are required for NATO admission.
Yeah.
But the United States changed its rhetoric to say, unequivocally, no matter what, Ukraine's position is in NATO, and that is not up for debate, which I assume is probably the deal they hammered out in Poland during the NATO conference, that Ukraine was mostly upset that that wasn't spelled out, that the idea of Ukraine membership would be part of a negotiated truce with Russia.
Ukraine still has to meet those qualifications, though. And that's the thing. Like, even Joe Biden was saying that you have to meet these.
And they both admit that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've been doing a thought experiment. This is semi-related to this, but it's been troubling me the last few days, and I'm going to air it here. If we had a system where 20% of the people made all the decisions for the other 80%, we would view that as tyrannical. We would say that that's not democracy, right? If you only had 20% of the people doing it. But then I got to thinking about it. And it's about the congressional voter turnout is between 40 and 50%. I think it's around 50% now. And it's usually a 20-point spread. So the actual amount of people that put people in power in the country is like 30%, 25%, something like that. Like the people that end up creating the power system, the elected leaders, is less than a majority of the citizens, including the citizens who vote. So it's just, or I should say, no, including the overall electorate. And I've been noodling that going, makes me uncomfortable.
I get what you're saying, and that makes me uncomfortable too, but that's also a choice, right? Like the half of us that are sitting out of the elections, that's a choice. It's not like we're not having the election. So we just need more people to choose to participate and those numbers change.
Yeah, but it's, okay, I agree, but it's still not actually a majority.
No.
And it weirds me out. I feel like I've got some soul searching to do.
Well, we have no searching to do for Andrew Heaton, sports expert question of the week. Will, play the Sports Center theme. What are your thoughts on UCLA and USC joining the Big Ten for the 2024 season, Andrew Heaton?
They absolutely have to do it. It's necessary for the continuation of both great teams, and there's no greater team coalition than the Big Ten.
Uh-huh.
They should join it, and the sooner the better, in my opinion, because you say yokels, but I say the rascals that they are currently associating with are even worse.
Which is the conference that they're leaving?
West 8, the West Coast 8 conference, because they're both California. And so it's West Coasters. And to me, this is so obvious. I'm not even going to deign to extol my logic.
Just give me one.
Da-da-da,
da-da-da, right there. Okay. Hollywood is vital to national interest rights. Why is this podcasting demanding that? Why is this podcast not demanding that Biden break the Hollywood strike by invoking the Taft-Hartley Act and nationalizing SAG and the Writers Guild of America?
Why would we do that?
Why don't we?
Because no.
This is a vital national. Have you guys followed this strike? Do you guys care about this, yeah. this strike?
Yeah, I did an episode on it last week, but I'm kind of interested in the long-term systematic implications of it. Like I'm interested in how it's going to affect Hollywood. I'm less interested in the individual components and who's winning and who's losing and that kind of thing. I don't know a whole lot about the Taft-Hartley Act. I'm aware of it, but I haven't recalled it in a while.
Of course, that's what you latch on to. That's what you latch on to is I need to review the Taft-Hartley Act.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to me that it would meet the threshold of national security or anything like that, or vital infrastructure or anything like that.
I mean, Jesus, it would fix the plot problems of Secret Invasion.
Yeah, our Congress will call anything national security. Like I watched a hearing last week about LIV Golf, and they talked about how it was a matter of national security who owns the PGA. So this Congress could spin it to where they get involved. I don't think they will, but this Congress can spin anything into national security.
A pharmacist with a great love of exercising writes, while deleterious psychiatric side effects such as anxiety and insomnia are associated with consumption of caffeine, there does not appear to be cardiac problems stemming from its use. When consumed, caffeine can cause transient and mild increases to blood pressure and heart rate, but long-term, it has not been associated with cardiovascular disease or mortality. Some observational studies of moderate consumers, usually defined as 300 to 600 milligrams, which is 7 to 14 cans of Diet Coke for reference, have even found it to lower long-term CVD risk. Cardiovascular disease.
So the studies on this, I mean, obviously I was a caffeine addict, and so I've looked into this, and the studies are kind of all over the place. So whatever you want to justify with your caffeine use, there are plenty of industry-sponsored studies that'll tell you that your caffeine use is just fine. My own personal heart palpitations when I drink caffeine tell me that it has an effect on the heart. Now, what I have read is that when you stop drinking caffeine, any negative effects that you're experiencing as an addict do get reversed. And so that's really good news. So there is, you know, it doesn't necessarily hurt your heart long term, but while you're using it, you cannot say that it doesn't have an effect on your heart. It absolutely does. In fact, I think there are about 6 people who have died because they took too much caffeine and then they exercised. And those deaths apparently are like related to the heart. So it's like, there are definitely effects. But you can find all kinds of different studies telling you that caffeine is fine. You just have to be really careful with those because a lot of them are funded by the industry. And a lot of people really want to believe caffeine is fine because over 80% of Americans are hooked on that shit. So, it's not a drug without effects.
I am one such American.
Hell yeah. Me too.
As a caffeine addict, I'd say a low level but highly functioning caffeine addict from the great state of Oklahoma, I am far more worried about diabetes and heart disease than I am about caffeine. I'm pretty, like, in my case, for my personal decisions, I'm more worried that a hamburger and lack of vegetables is going to kill me than the amount of coffee I'm drinking.
Yeah. And the only point that I was making is that...
they find fentanyl and Folgers.
The only point I was making is, like, I was an addict and there were negative effects for me and it was really hard to quit. And, like, that's all I'm saying. If you want to drink caffeine, I don't give a shit. It's, you know, it's better than cocaine. Like there's definitely like ranges of things that you can be addicted to that are worse or better. But like, you know, don't go around telling people that it has no effect on your heart because that's just not true.
Prime Defender writes, an important note that you miss is that there are 2 different kinds of Prime drinks, a sports drink and an energy drink. The sports drink is like Gatorade, so kids can drink it no problem. The issue is that some parents aren't checking which one they're buying when kids ask them for Prime. So that is a note, the fact that it is a dual brand, like a Gatorade and a Monster Energy drink. Because when we were discussing it, I did think it was only the Monster Energy drink side of it.
And I think that there's a role for putting labels and stuff in there. During COVID, I spent about a third of COVID at a cabin in Wagner, Oklahoma, and got a bunch of Crystal Light Did not know Crystal Light has caffeine in it.
Yeah.
Did not know why I couldn't sleep for 2.5 days. I was just going, what the fuck is wrong with me? And then finally looked at it and went, oh, that explains it. I've been drinking like two pots of coffee a day of Crystal Light and then not going to sleep and going, well, I guess I'll have more Crystal Light.
It does seem like there should be, anytime there's a drug in something, we should have it be obvious, because I'm sure on the Crystal Light, it's in teeny tiny little letters that you have to squint to see that there's caffeine in it. It should be much more obvious if there's any drug in anything that we take. And I think that's something we might be able to push for.
Well, I mean, was it iced tea? Crystal Light iced tea? Heaton?
It wasn't iced tea, but it was like that. It's like just, I don't know, Crystal Light flavored packets of, you put in a glass of water, like little sachets of Crystal
Light. Usually Crystal Light is either lemonade or iced tea. Those are the two most popular Crystal Light flavors.
No, I had like raspberry and I can't remember the other ones. It was pink, whatever it was. Yeah,
the flavored ones have caffeine.
Apparently some of them do and some of them don't. I've learned this now.
All right. So there was a thing that I used to do on an old show of mine, where if you would like to have me read your email with the angry email voice, I would. I'm just letting people know that I'm the captain now. And if I deem your email to be angry, I'm going to read it in the angry email voice. And I've got two of them that I'm going to read as such right now. Why are you picking on Russia? Writes, Putin doesn't have a murderous blood on his hands, and he's never been a thug. And the reason why he enjoys an 80% approval rating is because he single-handedly saved Russia from the evil machinations of the West, particularly the US and the CIA. You say unequivocally that Russia's the bad guy in this conflict. No. They aren't. They told the U.S. their security concerns forever. They presented treaty after treaty, all ignored and rejected. The CIA has been effing with Russia nonstop forever, and they've actively cultivated on the payroll ultra-nationalist and Nazi groups in Ukraine, specifically to harass Russia. They've killed 85,000 Russians during this period that Banderas was active in Ukraine. And I will hold your comment.
Is that a serious email?
While I read the next one. Why are you defending Russia? Writes, I was listening to your show, but could only endure until the 14-minute mark when the brutal invasion of Ukraine was called a civil war that started in 2014. There is not and has never been a civil war. It's an invasion from a neighboring country. Russia sent their army minus the flags to occupy Crimea in 2014. Crimea was then and is now a part of sovereign Ukraine. The same applies to the Donbass region. Now, admittedly, both in Crimea and in Donbass, there may possibly be a majority of the population in favor of belonging to Russia. But there's no way to know whether that is true or not, since the regions are invaded and occupied by Russia. There is, to be sure, some local militia in the region supporting the Russians, if you can find that to be a convincing argument in favor of occupying neighboring countries. So, apologies for Putin or a absolute opposite of that. Which are we? We should probably settle so these emailers can figure out which way to shoot.
I think it's good the audience sees what we deal with
here. I'm delighted that we've evoked so much anger from both sides of this. I'm not surprised by the the email that, you know, Russia is completely 100% bad in all things, and it was, you know, there's literally nothing else to it other than their evil. That one I'm not surprised by. The one that I'm surprised by is the Putin 80% approval rating. Yeah. I questioned the polling in Russia.
Yeah. Both of these were very long, and I cut them down for publication. But the pro-Russian one went on to denigrate our understanding of the situation by believing what was being fed to us by the mainstream media.
I mean, it's really hard to blame the mainstream media when the dude in February of last year invaded the other country with like tanks and jets and bombs and shit. Like it's really hard to claim that didn't happen. So I don't know that, but these are such perfect examples of how unhinged our emails are. Like it's really hard to speak publicly about things because people are going to see you however the fuck they want to see you. And this is such a good example. Like,
yeah.
To hear those emails, you would have no idea what we actually said in the last episode because those people are going to write those emails regardless of what we said. It's, oh, I hate emails.
Yeah. Well, I mean, number one, I think a lot of times in life, but specifically in this world of kind of semi-public conversation, you have to understand that you're somewhere along the line of a conversation that's already happening in their heads. And regardless of what you say or how much you try to couch it or whether or not you logically believe in the underpinnings of your argument, it's just going to fall into wherever they are. And podcasting is such a personal medium that people tend to take it very personally. There were a few people that wrote in and said, that's it. I'm never listening to the show again, blah, 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 because of this issue and others. And to them, I say, you didn't stop because you're listening to this right now. And, you know, vaya con Dios. Like there's no, everybody, there's a million different choices for things. I hope that eventually you come back and that you kind of take a deep breath and touch grass and realize that we are doing our best to have level-headed conversations. And that doesn't preclude us from being wrong. And we always look forward to, like, I really enjoyed that the guy that wrote, I think I forwarded to Jen, the long form email of the physician who had a thing about caffeine. And like, I think that we all always enjoy when people send sources and have thoughts about it. Whenever it's a well-reasoned one, I will send it to everybody. I won't read all of it here on the show because everybody else would find it boring. But yeah, I love it. I love the passion.
You know, a lot of issues are complicated, and I think they're difficult to distill down into a yay or boo. I think that they're more complex than that. And the one with Ukraine and Russia, I think, is a high stakes one, and it requires having a lot of different opinions contributing to it. So in addition to our chat last week, I was just on the Eastern Borders podcast with my friend, war correspondent Christoph Anderson. Who I'll start crying here in a minute. He got car bombed by the Wagner Group about 6 months ago. Like my buddy got fucking car bombed. You know, like near and dear to my heart. We don't see eye to eye on that. And I came on his program and we're very good friends and we'll share our different perspectives on what was happening. Now, from my perspective, I know that he's, one, got a lot of very, very, very good reasons for being passionate about his opinions. But I think that some of his ideas would be needlessly provocative and could push us towards nuclear war. I'm concerned. But from his perspective, I am going to be this Neville Chamberlain that sleepwalks us into tyranny. And like, both of those outcomes are bad, and that means that we need to have ideas that are being submitted. We need to be having these conversations because it is high stakes, and that means that we ought to be investigating them very thoroughly from many different perspectives.
Like, I don't think it's helpful to look at these situations as one side is all good and one side is all bad. And as soon as it devolves into, like, this one's evil and this one is, like, fighting for the righteous, that's where we get into trouble. I think we have to look at the culpability and the history of how both sides, even if, like, you know, in this Russia situation, in the current war, like, I will put Russia in the you have more culpability than Ukraine category. But there were historical events that led up to the situation that need to be analyzed in looking for the solutions. And if you're only looking at one side is evil and one side is good, you're not going to look at that history in order to find the solution. Unless your solution is that the other side needs to be completely eliminated. And that's just not something we want to get into.
I don't like the idea of attributing permanent evil status to any country.
Yeah.
Like saying, because I have friends that believe this, that Russia is just fundamentally evil. The people in it are fundamentally evil. And we need to just forever view them as an enemy state and forever attempt to weaken them. And like, history is a long time, guys. Like, yeah. 200 years from now, it might well be that Russia is a bastion of liberal democracy and Hayekian free markets and individual rights and things like that. And it could be, who the fuck knows? So, like, these are complex situations.
I'd bet no.
I bet no too. But I hope for it.
because of the stuff that we did, like invading Iraq and the torture, there are people on this earth that think America is pure evil. And so it's like, we can turn this around on ourselves and be like, do we want to be the target of those kinds of thoughts and feelings? Because like, I know I didn't torture anyone. I know I was against the Iraq war. And I'm sure there are people in Russia that are against the Ukraine war. So it's like, we have to remember that these are human beings just like us. And the country that they are born into doesn't necessarily speak for who they are. You just can't call an entire country's worth of people evil, because it just doesn't, it doesn't work that way. You are not your government. And I think we are perfect examples of that.
No one out Sphinxes the Sphinx, right? Heaton will be glad to know that the KFC next to the Sphinx issue has indeed been fixed. It's a Pizza Hut now.
Oh, no.
Great. All right. Well, I vaguely prefer the Pizza Hut over the KFC.
Fun facts about Plessy versus Ferguson, right? It was completely staged. A racist law required separate train cars for black and white people, and the train companies didn't want to do that because it was more expensive. So they literally hired Plessy to enter a white car and also paid someone to arrest him. It backfired, and the country, it backfired for them and the country when the court upheld separate but equal. So that goes to my new fascination of how many massive Supreme Court cases have been deliberately staged to push the limits of law.
I think people would be very surprised by that. Like the Scopes Monkey trial with William Jennings Bryan that features in Inherit the Wind. I think the teacher that was getting prosecuted, like, met with somebody in town, and they agreed that, like, if they could get a trial about it, it'd bring a lot of attention to the town and help tourism, and ended up getting turned into that. The instance with Rosa Parks, where she righteously did not want to have to sit at the back of the bus, but was selected because there were lots and lots of different women. She was the second.
They had a woman before that they were looking to do it,
but she had a kid, but she was unmarried or something, and they were worried and that was going to reflect
poorly.
She
wasn't great. She wasn't as good of a messenger as Rosa Parks was. Rosa Parks was a more elegant messenger for that. Former EOD team leader writes, the problem with cluster munitions is that there is an acceptable failure rate for all ordnance, and these systems put out so many pieces that every time you fire one, you do create a minefield. There are engineering reasons why making cluster weapons as tiny and interlocking as possible pushes their fuse reliability way down. The rounds also look less like overt weapons, and so people pick them up more often. So there you go. The more you
know. I'm throwing mine away.
And finally, Barbenheimer writes, Barbie, Oppenheimer, or both? This is the big decision for moviegoers this Friday. Jen, Barbie or Oppenheimer? Which one do you want to see this weekend?
Well, considering I'd have to see it in Espanol, a language I don't speak, I don't think I'll be going to the movies. But I would probably pick Oppenheimer because I don't really know the story. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to see Barbie in Scottish. I think that would be a really fun film. Oh, Ken, hop in the car.
Yeah,
let's go to the house. I'd watch that. I definitely want to see Oppenheimer, but I will probably see anything with Margot Robbie in it. So I'll probably see both.
She's so pretty.
I am going to see both. I'm doing a double feature. I got back-to-back tickets to see both of them this Friday. And my friend, Rachel, who is a literal Oppenheimer, is coming in to watch it with me. It's gonna be a blast.
What does that mean?
She's of the Oppenheimer family. She is related to J. Robert.
Oh, sure.
And she gets royalties from every nuclear bomb that's created. Yeah. A lot of people don't know that, but she's filthy fucking rich from all these nuclear weapons.
Every time one of them drops, she gets a 0.02 cents check, like she's a WGA writer.
She's always agitating for nuclear war. It's really, and like, now you know why.
But no, I told her as soon as I saw when it was coming out, I'm like, you got to come into town. Let's go see Oppenheimer together. And then a few weeks ago, she's like, I actually kind of want to see Barbie more. I don't really care about Oppenheimer. And I was like, well, fuck it. We're just going to, I'm clearing my schedule. We're just going to sit in a theater for 7 hours and watch movies. It's going to be a blast.
I love that. That'll be fun.
And she listens to this podcast. And I will tell you this,
I've known her since she was a teenager, and Heaton has been friends with her. And she was very, very kind to spend a lot of time with her during a very difficult period in her life. And she would throw us both into oncoming traffic if it meant hanging out with you, Jen Briney, for 15 minutes. She loves your role on this show to the point where, I just periodically get totally out of context text messages about how much you are an avatar for her and many others' thoughts and feelings on this show.
Oh, nobody wants to fuck Spock. That's how the world works. Nobody fucks Spock.
That's a telling explosion of your subconscious. Heaton, what do you got cooking on the orphanage?
I've got a thinky one this week. I've been thinking about this recently, that we designed our whole constitutional order on the idea that geography is extremely important, that Americans will think of themselves geographically and regionally. They will organize that way, and they will have to, because it takes a horse ride to get you from point A to point B. And we don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world that is less geographically important than it's ever been. And so I brought a guest on the Political Orphanage to talk about, if we were redesigning the system to not make geography paramount in it, what would it look like? So it's an interesting kind of just take on governance in general this week on the Political Orphanage.
And despite the fact that Jen was talking about the psychic damage that was done to her by this Congress and how much she didn't want to do her job as a podcaster, within 48 hours, you put out a podcast. What is it about?
I did. So the day after my mental breakdown on this very show, and by the way, I want to take a second and just thank everyone who reached out to me after that. You guys were so sweet and so supportive, and I'm so embarrassed. I don't know where that came from. Actually, I do. I had been feeling that for a while, but like, God, I had to do it in public. But the following day, after being very embarrassed about that and feeling guilty about not putting out a show, my mom wasn't feeling well. So I watched a hearing about the LIV Golf PGA merger, which we had talked about on this show. And so I was essentially watching it for fun. And it was interesting enough that I decided to take the 3 hours of that and condense it down to, you know, like they basically touched on five different topics. And so I just put the questions and the answers in an order that made sense. And it's basically like a montage show of what that hearing was. And it actually, I was able to produce it quite quickly. I really enjoyed doing it. The feedback has been really good. So it's not the usual format of Congressional Dish, but we might be onto something here, because it's basically a summary of the hearing. And if you liked that episode of We're Not Wrong about the merger, this gave us some more information. So I'm actually really proud and surprised at how much I love doing that episode. But I think your emails and messages, they helped me want to get back into the C-SPAN. So I just thank you to everyone in the audience for your support. And I'm still embarrassed, but some good came out of it. So thank you very much.
And on PX3, we have a sizzling summer six-pack of topics, up to and including my official designation that Mike Pence's campaign is on campaign Undertaker death watch after fundraising totals came out for the second quarter, the DeSantis reboot question mark, and more thoughts on Trump and his indictment. That is all in the most recent episode of Politics, Politics, Politics. For this show, we want to remind you that We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. If you're a patron, you get another topic. And if not, I would like to remind you, for Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.